This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 6th, 2019. Happy New Year. And welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature, with research co-pollster Mario Canseco, who gives his predictions for 2019. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who deserve it. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is the fifth death since 2015 of a person stuck inside a donation bin yet more evidence that governments can be asleep at the wheel? Charities need somewhere to accept clothes and other used goods around the clock, but the giant metal containers that mushroomed around the Lower Mainland in recent years were designed without safety in mind. Did anybody at a municipal hall or an office in the provincial government test these devices? The bins on public land are being removed or sealed after the latest death in West Vancouver of a 34-year-old man, but the ones on private property are expected to meet the same fate, albeit slower. Next, our governments need to wake up and figure out why people are desperate to steal used clothes and begin to attack that problem. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Zurad Ibrahim and John Power report, Pole Dance: How Asia's Politicians Are Mobilizing the Voting Masses. Thailand's election has special significance as the first since the military coup of 2014. In addition to Thailand, India and Indonesia will vote to decide who will lead their populations, totaling 1.6 billion people, or 20% of humanity. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and Indonesia's President Joko Widodo are both aiming for second terms. Religious nationalism holds sway over both contests, further eroding the multi-religious social compacts undergirding the two republics. The Philippines will have congressional polls, which could help determine which bloc could throw up the next president in 2022. The Philippine political establishment has been dumbfounded by Duterte's high approval ratings, despite his blatant disregard for the rule of law. Singapore's People's Action Party government may also call elections, and it is likely to take advantage of patriotic fervor to give it an extra edge. The 200th anniversary of British colonization, together with Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad's irrepressible needling of its neighbor, offer plenty of grist for the populist mill. In Australia, which goes to the polls in May, faith in democracy is at record lows, despite the country being one of the few in the developed world to escape the global financial crisis largely unscathed. Although the country's electoral system and compulsory voting has kept a full-blown populist revolution at bay, a decade of evolving leadership and policy inaction has fueled disillusionment and discontent. In the Star Online, Leonardo DiCaprio testifies before U.S. jury in probe of 1MDB. The actor made a secret appearance before a grand jury recently to testify as part of the U.S. Justice Department's investigation into 1MDB. Prosecutors consider DiCaprio a witness who can provide useful insights about Malaysian businessman Joe Low, who is alleged to have laundered billions of dollars from the investment fund and then financed a lobbying campaign to end the investigation. DiCaprio's spokesman has in the past said the actor was cooperating with the probe and was entirely supportive of all efforts to assure that justice is done in this matter. The U.S. DOJ had launched a probe following claims that stolen Malaysian public money was laundered through the U.S. financial system and filed lawsuits seeking some $1.7 billion in assets allegedly purchased with the cash. Tens of millions of dollars in stolen money was used in 2012 by former Prime Minister Najib Razak's stepson, who is an aspiring film producer, to fund the Hollywood film The Wolf of Wall Street, starring DiCaprio. They are also alleged to have bought real estate in Hollywood and London, masterpieces by Monet and Van Gogh, a yacht, and a private jet. And in ABC Australia, Emma Siosian reports, blue bottle jellyfish surge ashore in onshore winds, stinging thousands of beachgoers. Beachgoers looking to beat the heat on Australia's east coast need to be on the lookout for a familiar and unwelcome visitor, with vast numbers of blue bottles being pushed ashore by strong winds. Director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Service, Lisa Ann Gershwin, said the striking blue jellyfish lived in armadas in the middle of the ocean and had a keel-like crest and trailing tentacles. According to Surf Life Saving Queensland, during the past week, since December 28th, 13,243 blue bottle stings have been treated by lifesavers and lifeguards across Queensland, many at popular beaches on the Gold Coast and the Sunshine Coast. Since December 1st, more than 18,000 stings have been recorded in Queensland, compared to just more than 6,000 for the same period last year. Over the years, remedies for treating bluebottle stings have included ice, vinegar, and, get this, urine. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. First, Gene Johnson of Associated Press reports Washington Governor Inslee to pardon marijuana convictions. More than 6 years after the state legalized the adult use of marijuana, Washington Governor Jay Inslee said January 4th that he plans to pardon thousands of people convicted of small-time possession charges, the latest in a series of moves by states and cities to ease the burdens people face from having minor criminal records for using pot. The Democrat, who is mulling a 2020 presidential run, made the announcement at a cannabis industry summit in SeaTac, south of Seattle. Inslee said he was creating an expedited process that would allow about 3,500 people to apply for and receive a pardon without having to hire a lawyer or go to court. In the Times columnist, Mike Devlin reports, sounds right. After 44 years, missing guitar back with April Wine musician. Miles Goodwin of the band April Wine played a Gibson guitar on New Year's Eve that hadn't been in his hands for 44 years. It was mailed to his Halifax home from Victoria decades after the singer and guitarist assumed the instrument was gone for good. It was thought to have been destroyed when a truck carrying the band's gear crashed in Montreal in 1974. The guitar had changed hands several times over a 20-year period, in some cases under likely dubious circumstances. With his Gibson now safely back in his possession, Goodwin is sharing his story, one that is almost too fantastic to be true. Goodwin said he received a message through Facebook on December 24th from a person in Victoria with knowledge of a chestnut guitar with yellow finishes that had Goodwin's name engraved on the head. And in the Oregonian, Jamie Hale reports, road to Crater Lake closed due to human waste buildup. Crater Lake National Park remains open, but winter visitors will now need to hike a long way in after the National Park Service closed the road into the park due to issues brought about by the federal government shutdown. On January 3rd, park officials closed the southern entrance road at Oregon 62 due to a buildup of human waste in the park, a disturbingly common problem at national park sites as they remain unstaffed during the shutdown, which began December 22nd. National parks in the Pacific Northwest have remained open during the shutdown, but they haven't been staffed with rangers, and all facilities, including restrooms, have been closed. That has apparently led visitors to poop in the open without following proper leave-no-trace etiquette, creating a public health hazard. And we reported in the Breaker.News that new assessments show a dog playground is among Vancouver's priciest properties. A parking lot smaller than a hockey rink that was converted into a fenced gravel playground for dogs last year rose from $46.7 million in value to $70 million last July, according to the January 1st released property assessment. The Canine Corner is adjacent to the White Spot restaurant on West Georgia in downtown Vancouver, which saw its value rise from $104.3 million to $156.4 million. The popular eatery's new assessment is the equivalent of 19.6 million pirate packs. Both parcels were sold for $245 million in 2017 to Champion Rainbow Holdings Limited, a division of Hong Kong's Carnival International Holdings. Assessments are based on market value, including size, location, and area sales, and highest and best use potential. The former Chevron station site on the west end of that block is now $98.25 million, up from $65.5 million. Developer Anthem paid $72 million for that land. Add the parking lot west of White Spot, which is $24.5 million, and the entire block is now valued at just below $350 million. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. For the first interview of 2019, we welcome pollster Mario Canseco of Research Co. in Vancouver to look ahead to municipal, provincial, and federal politics in 2019.
This is the first calendar year in power for new Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart and new old Surrey Mayor Doug McCallum. Transportation will be a big issue, of course, so will public safety. What do you expect in the next 12 months for both the new mayors of Vancouver and Surrey?
Well, I think they are both coming into this at a very good time, particularly because of the federal election. There's going to be a need for the Liberal Party to reconnect with British Columbians, particularly those who are disappointed with the decisions related to the pipeline and the lack of electoral reform at the federal level. And the best way to do so is to cut ribbons. So there's going to be a lot of announcements, lots of things related to transportation, particularly when it comes to Vancouver and the Arbutus Corridor. It's essentially a few blocks away from the riding of the Justice Minister, Julie Wilson-Raybould, so you definitely want to win that seat back. And I think this is helpful for both Doug McCallum and Kennedy Stewart, because they are now having a federal government that is not only willing to do things, but also desperately wanting them to happen quickly so they can be used to get voters before the next federal election, which is happening later in the year. So I think it's a good moment as far as the timing goes. For Kennedy Stewart, I think the biggest issue is going to be how to connect with voters who are disenchanted about housing. It was a fairly close election. Housing was the number one issue. I think there's definitely a need to talk about issues related to housing and essentially try to stop all of those anecdotes of people who are abandoning the city of Vancouver because they can't afford to live here. Surrey is going to be a little more complicated, even though you look at it from the standpoint of a specific political party or slate having a majority control. There's a little bit of tension going on. I think that's been evident over the past couple of months as far as where the situation might go. And Mayor McCallum seems to be very adamant on specific things that he wants to do, particularly on the whole transportation file, but also as it relates to public safety. So I think there's definitely a need to figure out a way to solve the situation and to make Surrey residents feel safer. The last time we asked them, they didn't feel safe at all. It's definitely not a situation that can change overnight, but that is going to be one of the major challenges for them.
Since you brought up the federal scene, we'll talk about that next, because the federal election is coming up in October. We're getting close to the 10-month countdown as Justin Trudeau and the federal Liberals will seek a second term against Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives, against Jagmeet Singh and the NDP. And of course, we've got the Greens under Elizabeth May and then the upstart Maxime Bernier with his People's Party of Canada. What do you make of all this? It really is Trudeau's to lose in many ways.
I would say so, basically because it's a situation that is in a way reminiscent of the elections when Jean Chrétien had massive majorities. Now you're going to have a force from the small C conservative side of things with Maxime Bernier's People Party trying to get some votes that are going to come from the conservative side of things. So that could split the center right vote depending on how successful he is recruiting candidates. We know that he's talking to people in every single riding. He's trying to figure out a way to get things done. Gorman Growell is helping him in British Columbia, and he's somebody who's very well known. So that could take about 5 or 6% of the vote from the Conservatives and enable the Liberals or the NDP to win those seats. So there's definitely some advantages for the opposition because of it. But I think part of the situation is really trying to figure out whether people trust Andrew Scheer to handle the country. Every election where we've had a change, we've always had that moment in the final week when the opposition leader is seen as a better economic manager or as a better manager of the country as a whole. And to me, that's the number that I would focus on as we get closer to that. You know, we essentially had a last federal election campaign that started with the NDP way ahead, questions about how Prime Minister Mulcair would handle things, and then everything sort of shifted in the end. But ultimately, I think part of the situation is nobody really saw Mulcair as PM material, if you will. And I think Andrew Scheer's biggest challenge is, can he do something more than just focus on the base that is very happy with the things that he's saying as far as being fiscally conservative and socially conservative, but actually get some voters who supported the Liberals to go back into the conservative column. So I think that's the biggest challenge, and it's even more difficult to do if you have somebody like Maxime Bernier who is sitting out of your base.
And here in British Columbia, of course, we've got the situation where the Greens are keeping the NDP in power. There is a very important by-election coming up at the end of January in Nanaimo. There's also whispers of recall campaigns. I'm not sure how well organized those may or may not be. What do you think we'll see at the end of January and how that will affect everything going forward?
Well, it's definitely going to be difficult for the Liberals to take the seat in Nanaimo. It's a well-organized campaign. The NDP has been very popular there. They've only lost in this century in the 2001 blowout under Gordon Campbell, where the NDP only got two seats. I don't think it's an easy undertaking. I think that they might be feeling a little more confident because of the defeat of the PR referendum. But I wouldn't read too much into that, particularly because, you know, we came off the HST referendum with the assumption that the Liberals were done. We came off the April 2012 by-elections that were won by the NDP, both of those seats, essentially assuming that there was a change in the air. And then when the election happened in 2013, both of those seats went back to the Liberals. So even if Nanaimo is lost, which I don't think is going to happen necessarily, I don't think it's going to affect too much the way the government is working. I think it'll be more difficult for the NDP, and essentially they'll have to keep everybody in Victoria, because if you lose a vote, then you could trigger a new election. But it's not a situation right now where the Liberals would be wise to try to topple the government. We still see Andrew Wilkinson as an unknown leader, somebody who hasn't really connected very well. And even though things can change in the campaign, it's been really difficult for him to get a little bit of traction with the voters. And the economy is doing okay. The unemployment levels are low. All of those fears about the NDP handling finances and doing away with BC's AAA rating have dissipated. So, you know, part of the situation for the voters is, do we really need to do this? Are we all electioned out, coming out of a municipal election and then the referendum and then in a couple of months having another provincial ballot? So I just don't think it's going to happen unless something really drastic takes place. Let's say something related to the investigation into the legislature, or something related to money laundering, something that helps the NDP say, gave us a majority mandate and nothing like this is going to happen again. So if it's triggered, I think it'll be triggered by the NDP more than the Liberals.
And that really is the elephant in the room in provincial politics right now, the scandal at the legislature with Gary Lenz, the sergeant at arms, as well as Craig James, the clerk of the legislature, both suspended with pay November 20th. The RCMP are investigating. There's an extraordinary two, count them, two special prosecutors. Daryl Plekis is promising, the speaker Daryl Plekis is promising to table some information later this month that doesn't compromise the police investigation, but does give us a clearer picture of what went on in the background of the legislature, which exists in a vacuum. It's not under the auspices of the Freedom of Information Law. So this really could be what affects provincial politics going forward.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of potential there for damages for both of the main political parties. If this situation is something that began under the BC Liberals, the NDP is going to try to pin it on them. Similar situation what we saw with the money laundering discussions. If it's something that happened under the NDP's watch, then obviously the Liberals are going to say that it's their fault. And we're going to get into another round of, you didn't do anything and we tried to help. But similar situation to what we've seen with ICBC over the past few months. But this has very, very damaging potential, particularly for the government. I mean, when you hear the Speaker of the House say that this is the kind of situation that makes your stomach turn, it's not a metric that I've ever used in a survey I conducted. But once everything comes out, I think it's definitely something that we should do, particularly because it's one thing to be upset about politicians, and we've seen how they're usually ranked very low when you're asking people about professions. But these are the people who are supposed to be safeguarding everything. And if you have a situation that is related to corruption or anything that is unsavory coming out of Victoria, then that definitely throws a wrench into the whole process. And it's going to be even more difficult to hold an election when you have a situation like this. So this is one of the reasons why I don't think that the election would be in the best interest of the parties at this particular stage. If you have a situation where the people have lost faith in the political process, let alone the way politicians are handling it, you could be in for a big surprise.
And finally, the wild cards that will have an impact one way, shape, or form here in British Columbia. President Donald Trump, our southern neighbor, President Donald Trump, and of course our second biggest trading partner, China, and their President Xi Jinping. This is Donald Trump's second full calendar year in the White House. There's some questions about whether he might make it to the end, if there might be an impeachment that might happen. Xi Jinping is a little more stable because this will be his first full calendar year as essentially the Chinese president for life after the term limits being canceled last year. You know, of course, right now we've got some intrigue as this trade war happens, and Huawei chief financial officer Meng Wanzhou lives in Dunbar under bail, waiting for extradition proceedings to start. And of course, the Chinese have retaliated there. What do you think, and where do you think the BC relationships with the United States and relationships with China will go in 2019?
Well, it's a very tough one, particularly as it relates to the situation with China. You know, there's offices, there's things that were started by the previous Liberal government that the NDP has tried to maintain as far as trying to build a better trade relationship with China. This is going to make it even more complicated because we're starting to see the effects of having so many incredibly wealthy people buying homes, and it's starting to percolate. I think it was something that was probably only in social media 6 months or a year ago, and now it's starting to be discussed a little more openly. So that's definitely going to lead to some difficulties for the government to try to connect with China and to try to make it look like this is something that's going to be beneficial for BC residents. On the Trump file, I think there's also the possibility of the invocation of the 25th Amendment. I think the actions of the president over the past couple of days, particularly assuming that he can call this a national emergency and do whatever he wants and essentially conceivably impose martial law, is going to lead to very heavy discussions within the cabinet. And you know, I don't think we've seen so many changes in a cabinet happen as rapidly as we've seen over the past few months. We haven't seen a defense minister quit in the way that he did. And there's definitely going to be a lot of pressure there. I think the fact that the House is discussing impeachment, it's essentially geared towards making Republicans think about this. It's more about the Republican who always votes Republican, who's not a Trump supporter, who isn't happy with everything that is going on, and try to tell them, look, this is about the future of the country, and this is the way in which this could happen. But that being said, I don't foresee a scenario where his approval rating is going to drop lower than 35%, maybe 30% at some point. George W. Bush was in the 20s, Nixon was in the 20s, and those are definitely tougher situations because there's no base to speak of. He does have a base, and it's been very adamant in the fact that he's following up on his own promises. So ultimately, I think it's more about laying down the groundwork for 2020 if you're a Democrat and trying to figure out who you run against them. And we saw Elizabeth Warren announcing where there's discussions about other candidates who may or may not decide to jump into the fray. But you need somebody who's the standard bearer in order to defeat Trump. When you have a situation where you have a president who is an incumbent and you say, well, whoever from the other party, you're usually going to get a 50-50 response. So I wouldn't buy too much into those surveys at this stage until we have somebody who's actually said, I am running against Trump.
That was my interview with Mario Canseco of Research Co. Learn more about Research Co. at researchco.ca. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to those who make a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all of you out there who are kicking off the new year by taking a break from the bottle with the Dry January Challenge. Research from 2018 by the University of Sussex in England says 88% of those who went dry after New Year's saved money, 71% slept better and had more energy, and 58% lost weight. So, if you're taking the Dry January Challenge, enjoy a virtual Nanaimo Bar because it has no calories. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Go to sprucehill.ca for more information. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 6th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on January 6th in 2001, the United States Congress certified George Bush as the winner of the 2000 presidential election over Al Gore? Gore had 543,000 more votes than Bush, but where it counts, Bush had 271 electoral college seats versus 266 for Gore. In Florida, Bush won by only 537 votes. Now you know. Send your feedback. Send your story ideas to me, bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. PATREON.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.